sleep deprivation affects mood more than any other performance factor. Time to exhaustion increases with good sleep. So the better sleep you have, the longer you can go on a treadmill, let's say.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, who thinks Keep On Moving by Five is one of the greatest songs of all time, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 106 of the Running For Real podcast. Thank you so much for being here today. If this is your first episode here, welcome. You are in for a good one, and it's one that we wish we didn't have to have a conversation about, but it's important nonetheless. If you are a loyal listener, thank you for being here. You are wonderful. So last week we had the US record holder for the half marathon and 204 marathoner, no big deal, Ryan Hall on the show. And I told you how I was a little worried Ryan would be holding back with his answers, but he really didn't. I learned a lot, and it was interesting to get into his mind and see that he too struggles with the same thing of being hard on himself that we struggle with. Yes, even the fastest American of all time in an event struggles with the same things we do. Pretty eye-opening, right? You may also remember that a few weeks ago, I had Christy Ashwandan on the show, and she was telling us what she found about the various recovery tools and how the number one, two and three, I should say, recovery tool was in fact sleep. But I don't know about you, but for me, the more importance that is put on sleep, the more I get stressed out about getting enough and I can't actually sleep. So I thought we would help with that and get a sleep performance expert on. The sleep performance expert Christy herself recommended. Amy Bender was happy to come on the show, and we have all kinds of advice for you here. Now, I tried to do my usual of asking all the things we might be wondering while she's talking, and I hope I did a good job of asking your questions as they might come up in your mind. And I want to send a thank you to the Patreon supporters who also gave me some additional questions to ask. You can go support me on Patreon if you want to. No pressure, though. Pass this episode on to your running friends. It could literally be the difference between a goal they've been chasing for years and actually doing it, or being injured and not. If we could all get our sleep sorted, who knows what we can achieve? Now, before I get to the show, I want to let you know about something I've started doing. As you know, I have show notes for the episode, which is a summary that my writer Jacob does a fantastic job of writing kind of what happened in the episode. Now, I'm happy to email you the summary for the episode, the main points, what we learned, and that means you can also pass it along to friends, particularly those who are not into podcasts. Although really, if they don't like podcasts, you might want to reconsider if they should really be your friends. I am just kidding, obviously. But go to tinamuir.com/show notes if you want to get those sent to you, and just put your email in there and I will send them to you. Or you can just send me an email, tina@tinamuir.com, and let me know that that's what you would like. You should also send me an email if you're going to be in Boston on April 14th. I would love to meet you. So send me an email, as I said, tina@tinamuir.com, and I will let you know of the details. The time has changed since I gave you the time a few weeks ago, so be sure to let me know. I can add you to the list, and we're going to have a wonderful time. All right, let's meet a new sponsor, Nooni, and hear from Aftershocks, and we will get to the episode. This podcast is brought to you by NooniShop.com. Don't let knee pain help you from completing your long runs or worse, sidelining you altogether. Nooni is designed specifically to relieve that dreaded runner's knee pain. Unlike a typical knee sleeve, Nooni relieves the pressure at the source of the pain. And the research reveals if you get the pressure away, you get the pain away. Runners from coast to coast are getting instant relief with Nooni, and Nooni can help you get back to running without knee pain. Use code Tina Muir at NooniShop.com. That's NUNEESHOP.com for a 20% discount. This episode is sponsored by Aftershocks, the award-winning headphone brand. Best known for its open-ear listening experience, powered by patented best-in-class bone conduction technology, Aftershocks headphones sit outside your ear so you can hear your music and your surroundings, I know. Aftershocks is a must-have for runners, providing the ultimate level of safety and comfort without compromising sound quality. To learn more and save $50 on Aftershocks endurance bundles, visit tina.aftershocks.com. That's tina.aftershocks.com. Amy, thank you so much for being here today with me on the Running For Real podcast. Christy Ashwandan, a previous guest of this show, recommended you as the absolute expert that I should be bringing on here to talk about sleep and performance, something I know all my listeners are very interested in. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Tina, for having me. My pleasure.
Yeah, this is going to be really fun. So I would love for you to maybe start, for those listeners who do not know who you are, or maybe haven't, you know, heard about what you do. I mentioned that it is related to sleep and performance, but maybe you could tell the listeners just kind of what your focus is in your opinion, or what kind of brought you to learning more about sleep.
Well, I started off as a sleep technologist at Washington State University Sleep and Performance Research Center, and just landed that job by luck. My aunt was a sleep tech at the time. She kind of showed me the ropes a little bit and ended up getting that job and loved it. I mean, this, as it turned out, you know, that lab is one of the world-renowned sleep labs across the world. So I started working there, was looking at all of the physiological signals related to sleep, and taught research assistants, you know, how to do the overnight hookups with all the wires, scored the sleep stages while I was there, and then decided to go to graduate school at the time. So I ended up doing my master's and PhD focusing on sleep EEG and cognitive performance related to sleep deprivation. And then being an athlete myself, I just grew up playing sports all the time. I knew I wanted to somehow relate that to athletes. So I ended up getting funding to do a postdoc at University of Calgary, working with Canadian National Olympic Team athletes and optimizing their sleep. And so I was lucky enough to work with the curling team, the speed skating team, the rowing team, figure out ways to optimize their sleep in order to improve performance. And then during that time, I also did validated the athlete sleep screening questionnaire, which is the only questionnaire designed to screen athletes for sleep problems. And then now I'm doing some consulting related to athletes, but I'm also working at Calgary Counseling Center trying to optimize sleep for better mental health outcomes.
Wow, that's awesome. And what a journey you've been on to kind of get to this point, and the things that you've learned and the people you've been able to work with. That's pretty impressive. And just curious, you mentioned there about working with Olympic athletes. For those listeners who, you know, might be listening along and thinking, oh, you know, athletes are so good, or particularly like elite or top level athletes are so good at sleeping. You know, they talk about 10 to 12 hours a night. They rest all the time. Was that what you found, or what did you kind of discover about high level athletes? Are they able to just kind of sleep when they need to? They need all that extra recovery and they're able to do it, or were there some problems there?
Actually, I mean, based on the questionnaire, so normally in the sleep athlete field, we were using questionnaires that weren't designed for athletes. And what people were finding was that over 50% were flagged as having sleep problems. And we just knew clinically that that wasn't the case. So that's why we felt the need to validate the athlete sleep screening questionnaire. And it's now more like 25%, which is similar or in line with the general population. But no, it was actually the opposite. So, you know, you think exercise is really important for sleep quality. So, you know, then that should mean that athletes should be sleeping better. But I think that they're just juggling so many things. So for example, with the curlers, you know, a lot of them had full-time jobs, they have their training, they're traveling, you know, so there's a number of different factors that are preventing them from getting good sleep. And that was the case all around, that there were issues mainly due to travel, potentially evening training or early morning training is where we saw some of those issues coming up.
Really? Yeah, that is quite surprising. And that's why I kind of wanted to highlight that, because, I know from my own experience that I didn't particularly sleep well when I was an athlete, but I know that, you know, the logical brain, and you hear it all the time, that's one of the tips given out, isn't it? Exercise will help you sleep. And so you'd think, oh, these people just, you know, hit the pillow and they'll be out. But, you know, like you said, all the travel aspect is just one part of it, but that does make a big difference. And going to events or competitions in different places is going to affect with that. And you mentioned, you know, about 25% kind of now matches up with the general population. So my first question was going to kind of be just how sleep deprived are we? Because we hear all these, you know, articles and these about these studies that, you know, we're all just so sleep deprived and everyone is struggling. But is it as bad as it seems kind of in the media?
I mean, it depends on who you ask, honestly. There's sleep scientists, you know, if you look at some sleep scientists believe, you know, you should be aiming for that 8 hour. The general recommendation is between 7 and 9. So that's kind of the general, the healthy range. Okay. But if you look at 8 hours and up, only a third of Americans and pretty much across the world are hitting that mark. If you go down a little bit to that 7 hour mark, then we're looking at about two thirds are able to hit that mark. So I'd say, to be safe, I'd say about a third of us are walking around like zombies, sleep deprived.
And, you know, I know you have 3 kids and, you know, I have obviously a daughter, and I know a lot of the listeners do have children or maybe not even kids. Maybe they've got like a new puppy, or maybe they've just got some stressful stuff at work going on and they think it's just not possible for me to get 8 to 9 hours or, you know, more than 8, or even sometimes more than 6, more than 5, especially if someone's sick or if something is going wrong. Like, is this, you know, we hear that banking sleep doesn't really work, that you can't really make up for lost sleep. But is it kind of the case that if you have maybe a few bad nights, that you can kind of get away with it and it's okay as long as you get back into it? Or, you know, should we be trying to make up for any sleep that we've lost?
That's a great question and highly debated amongst us sleep people. There was a recent book out by Matthew Walker, and he believes that you cannot make up for lost sleep. And I think that's true to a certain point. I think if I pull an all-nighter, it's going to be difficult for me to make up minute for minute, you know, what I lost. But in my opinion, I have a much different opinion. You know, I studied sleep deprived subjects after they've been awake for 62 hours, and I saw the changes in their EEG, and the brain was compensating. So in my mind, I think the brain compensates a little bit for that lost sleep. And the other argument I would say is that I'm a parent, you know, I have 3 kids, 6 and under. I'm losing sleep all the time. And if you look at the data related to parents and mortality, parents actually outlive those who don't have kids. So in my argument, you know, my argument would be somewhere along the line, we're making up for that. And, you know, it's probably related to other factors as well. But in my opinion, I do think that we can make up for lost sleep. I think that the brain compensates. And if you do look at the banking sleep literature, which we should definitely talk about as a strategy later on, those who get more sleep leading into a sleep deprivation period perform better. So I think there's ways to mitigate that sleep deprivation that you're suffering from.
Okay. And then what about the other end of the spectrum, someone who maybe doesn't have kids, but they're, I don't know, setting up a business, or they're doing some kind of job that, you know, requires them to stay up all night, and they literally, you know, might be getting 2, 3, 4 hours of sleep, but, you know, they say, oh, I'm so wired, you know, I'm so excited about what I'm doing. What kind of harm is that doing for that kind of person? Because we've all been in that stage at some point, whether you're studying for a test in college or something like that. Like, you know, how much performance wise, both physically and kind of, you know, mentally with, you know, tasks that we might be doing or work that we might be doing, how much does it affect us?
I mean, it does. So I don't want to downplay the impact of sleep deprivation on our well-being. So I think everyone should aim to get 7 hours of sleep per night. And for those actually who think they can get by on less, let's say 6 hours or less, if we look at the population, that's actually less than 1% of the population that are true short sleepers that can get by on less than 6 hours of sleep per night without any performance decrement. So if you think that's you, it's probably not. But sleep deprivation, it impacts so much of our everyday living. You know, mood is impacted. So sleep deprivation affects mood more than any other performance factor. Decision-making is impacted, so you take riskier decisions when you're sleep-deprived. If we're talking about an athlete, time to exhaustion increases with good sleep. So the better sleep you have, the longer you can go on a treadmill, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Or in a race, be able to push yourself. Yep.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And if we're looking at, you know, hormones related to metabolic hormones are impacted by sleep deprivation. So with 5 hours of sleep for 1 week, you know, that reduces testosterone by 10 to 15%. Aging a 20-year-old to the age of a 40-year-old when we're talking about testosterone, reaction time is impacted. Injury, there's a higher injury risk. Immunity, so those who get better sleep get sick less often. So there's so many things that it impacts, and I don't want to downplay that. I think you just want to try and think of sleep across the week. So if you aren't hitting that 7, 7.5, 8 hour mark, how can you make up for it across the week? Can you get more sleep leading into that sleep deprivation period, or can you recover more after? And we have to be flexible, but we need to try and, you know, make up for that lost sleep if we can.
Yeah. All right. And what about naps? Can naps make up for it? Is that kind of, you know, another thing that is often heard is, you know, the time before midnight is better than after. Like, is that the case that if you're going to get less sleep, but you get it kind of before midnight, that's better? Or can you just take extra naps to make up for it? How do those two aspects come into this?
Well, we haven't really talked about, so we've talked about sleep duration or sleep quantity. We've talked a little bit about sleep quality. Sleep timing is important as well. And it really depends on your chronotype. So whether or not you're a night owl or an early bird as to the timing of your sleep and how you want to fall asleep. So if I'm more of a night owl, having a later bedtime is going to be good for me because that's when my melatonin, my sleepy hormone is going to start to be releasing later than if I'm an early bird. So I think timing depends on what you are. And about 15% of us are night owls, 15% of us are early birds, and the rest of us kind of fall in between. Related to napping, napping is huge. It is, I think, one of the really important factors that a lot of athletes don't take advantage of us, even the general population. You know, in the study that we did, we found about a third of athletes napped about 1 to 2 times per week, and the rest, you know, failed to hit that mark. So napping is huge. There's a lot of strategies we can talk about with that. I think the timing of the nap you want to have in the afternoon, between 1 and 4 p.m., kind of when your circadian rhythm, your alertness levels are at their lowest point. Depending on the type of athlete you are, so if you are training early in the morning, if you have some early morning runs, you probably want to supplement during the day with a longer nap to try and make up for that lost nighttime sleep. But if you've gotten a sufficient amount of sleep at night, we want to aim for under 20-minute nap, because then you're not getting into the deeper stages of sleep where you wake up feeling really groggy.
So I'd love to talk about that more with regards to kind of the duration of naps. And you mentioned the timing there, which is really handy. And, you know, I know that a lot of my listeners are really into, you know, being their best person, want to perform and might be marathon training or something like that. You know, a job might not allow for a nap every day, but hearing you say that maybe on the weekends they can kind of sneak in a few naps between 1 and 4, as you said. But you mentioned there about that grogginess feeling, and that for me, even when I was running 100 miles a week, I just hated taking naps because I hated that feeling in the afternoon, feeling essentially hungover. So that was kind of what put me off. But you mentioned the short, like, power nap under 20 minutes, and you mentioned kind of the longer 1 to 2 hour nap. Is it a case of you know, if you can get the 2 hour nap in, that's great. But if you can't, you know, a 20 is better than nothing, or is it kind of a certain, you know, if someone doesn't like the 1 to 2 hour nap, then a 20 minute is fine. What are some more thoughts on the power nap versus the kind of longer nap?
Well, I would say, to your first point about it's difficult to take a nap, you know, during the workday. And I agree, but is there an opportunity? Could you go out to your car during your lunch break? I mean, if you had a really poor night's sleep, can we make up for a little bit of lost sleep with this power nap? So I would argue to try a little harder. I think many people just go, you know, they'll run to Starbucks or whatever to get a cup of coffee and I, you know, to help pick them up. But yeah. I mean, in that time you could be napping. So
okay. It
even a 5 minute, even a 10 minute, you know, even just closing your eyes for that time and not necessarily falling asleep is going to be beneficial because it's going to increase that parasympathetic nervous system, that relaxation system. So I would say try a little harder in that regard during the week if you can. And then related to what type of nap I should be taking, I think if you have a 2 hour opportunity, you want to try and wake up naturally after a full sleep cycle. So we didn't really talk about this, but we go from lighter stages of sleep into deeper stages of sleep. And then around that 90-100 minute mark, we're going to be getting into some of that REM sleep. And so if you have that longer nap opportunity, I think not setting alarm in that instance would be good. Maybe we tell our athletes to set an emergency alarm potentially at the 2 hour mark. But what you really want to do is wake up prior to that alarm after a completed sleep cycle, and you'll be more refreshed and you'll be ready to take on the day.
So if someone does, you know, set an alarm and does wake up feeling particularly groggy, that's probably that you maybe have, you know, gone through a whole cycle and essentially gone back into another one, and you're waking yourself up, and that's why you feel so bad.
Yes. I was going to ask you, when you tried taking the naps, do you think maybe you were getting into that deeper stages of sleep and that's why you were taking more of a longer 30 minute nap, or what was the duration?
Yeah, probably. I mean, I don't really remember too much because I did it a few times and felt so bad. I was like, I just don't even want to do this. But I did, I will say, the 20 minute nap. And as you mentioned, you know, not even essentially going to sleep, but sometimes I swear it felt like I'd lie down, I'd kind of be kind of in that in and out stage for a while. And I swear it felt like I actually slept for like a minute, and then I woke up, but it was like, bing. And I just suddenly was like, oh, I actually feel really, like, really good, a lot better. So I don't know how long I actually slept. I think in some cases it was just 10 minutes of actually, you know, checking out essentially. But like you mentioned, just that lying down, the being still, especially in a busy life. And actually that leads on nicely to a question I had from Mike, who wanted to know about, you know, do you still get the restorative properties from a nap if you can't switch your brain off? Because maybe, like you mentioned, going to your car to take a nap, or maybe you're in the middle of a really stressful day. Is it okay if you even just lie there? Do you still get a lot of the kind of recovery aspect if you're not actually drifting off into proper sleep?
Yes, you do. So neurons actually kind of shut off when you are laying there and closing your eyes. So you don't need to actually get into sleep to get benefits. I mean, obviously, if you can fall asleep, you're going to get more benefits than if you can't. But even just taking the opportunity to close your eyes, relax, maybe do some deep breathing is going to be beneficial than not doing anything at all.
Okay, that's really good. And I'm glad to hear you say that, because I think that's what a lot of people maybe get nervous or don't want to take naps because they think, well, what's the point? I'm not going to sleep anyway. But it's good to know. So I'd love to go into this a bit more, because I know this is a huge topic. And I have had a podcast on sleep in the past, and it was Dr. James Mars. I'm not sure if you've heard of him or not, but he was talking about kind of a lot of the benefits and how, you know, how much it helps you getting that good sleep, you know, 8 to 9 hours, all this. And I remember thinking at this time, I was still heavy into my insomnia phase. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I was running very high mileage, but I couldn't sleep. And I know a lot of my listeners struggle with this. You might be exhausted, so physically tired, but you know, maybe go to bed really early thinking, I'm going to get in this good habit, I'm going to get lots of sleep, but you just cannot fall asleep. And I mean, you know this, the more frustrated we get thinking, why am I not asleep? I need to get to sleep. I must get my sleep. The less likely it is. And it's just this horrible negative spiral that kind of happens. So first, maybe if you could tell us, like, how is this the case? You might be so physically exhausted, but you can't switch your mind off. You know, is that just something we kind of have to deal with in this world? Or what are some thoughts or some things you've kind of learned from your work that you've been doing?
Well, I'll tell you why, the primary reason why it's happening. So when you don't get enough sleep, it actually revs up your sympathetic nervous system. So you're in kind of that fight or flight response, which leads to increases in cortisol. So stress hormones are triggered by this overactive sympathetic nervous system. And that's why you're so exhausted, but you feel so wide awake, because you have kind of this cortisol alerting you and keeping you awake. So that's kind of the reason why that's happening. And I think definitely your point about the harder we try to sleep, the harder it's going to be. So I think trying to incorporate more of the relaxation prior to bedtime is really important in this situation. And so having a good bedtime routine is going to be important.
Kind of like a baby.
Absolutely. So it's important for babies. It's important for toddlers. And it's also important for adults. I mean, we can't just turn off the light and expect to fall asleep in no time. We have to prepare our body and our mind for sleep. And so things that we can incorporate into that bedtime routine, number one, shutting off the electronics an hour before bedtime, dimming the lights, doing relaxing activities. So not trying to, you know, send out a bunch of emails right before bed or work on work and those things. Doing some stretching is important. Even gratitude journaling. So the research has shown that gratitude, if you can write down 3 to 5 things, even just during the day, they find that those people sleep better.
Oh, I love that.
And yeah, and it's related to their kind of offloading thoughts from their mind. It's related to like cognitive thoughts before bed. Another thing that would be important is a to-do list. Yes. So writing a to-do list to offload some of those thoughts as well right before bed is a good thing. And then I think incorporating breathing exercises prior to going to sleep. So there's the 4-7-8 breathing, where you breathe in for 4 seconds, hold your breath for 7, and then breathe out for 8. And you repeat that 4 times. And that is a technique that will activate that parasympathetic nervous system, decrease our sympathetic nervous system activity, and help us relax and get better sleep.
Okay, so I'm just going to be a bit of a devil's advocate here, just because, funny enough, Amy, you don't know this, most of my listeners do, but having my daughter actually cured my insomnia, I can sleep really well now. I don't know why, but like having her just seemed to, I don't know, just do it for me. But
oh, wow.
I remember being thick in this insomnia thing, and hearing you say what you just said, you know, switching off electronics, although you know, I know a lot of my listeners are going to be thinking, you know, my day is so busy. I just want to kind of veg out and watch a TV show. And you're telling me to switch my electronics off. Like, some people will be saying, okay, I get it with the phone. I can put my phone away. But like, can I not just watch a TV show? But not so much that being the problem, but saying, okay, I'm going to switch off my TV. I'm not going to have that. But I'm going to do this big routine. I'm going to stretch. I'm going to breathe. I'm going to write in my journal. I'm going to write my to-do list. I'm going to do all this. So now I'm going to go up into bed. And this had better work because, you know, I've done all this stuff and I've given up my TV. So, I know this is what I would have done. I would have got, you know, done all this and been like, all right, I've done what I needed to do. Now give me my kind of reward of going straight to sleep. So how do you go from doing that without that putting more pressure on to be like, okay, well, I've done this to try and get myself to sleep, so now I just need to sleep? Mm-hmm. I know that's a tricky question, but I know that's where my mind would have been.
Yes. Well, I think there's a difference between insomnia and those just kind of struggling here or there with a poor night's sleep. So I think if you are having troubles with insomnia, if you're having difficulty initiating and maintaining sleep, if you're waking up early in the morning, and this is occurring three nights per week and it's lasted over 3 months, I think there's a professional needs to be involved here. So don't try and do it on your own. And I know a lot of people suffering from insomnia, they've tried all of the things that I just mentioned, and it still doesn't work. And it's related to the thoughts that are going on, the thoughts and the associations with sleep. And that really needs a professional to be involved at that point. And so I guess I actually listened to a great podcast the other day. It was the Sleep Junkies podcast. And the topic was cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And I think that's a good start for people to go who are suffering from insomnia at least 3 days a week for 3 months. Start with that podcast because it's going to give you an overview of this gold standard for treating insomnia. And then from that point, there are online programs that you can use that will help you. There are books that you can access. So one of the books when I was working at Center for Sleep and Human Performance that we would recommend for our patients was Sink into Sleep by Judith Davidson. And that was a really good workbook for people suffering from insomnia. So I think there's a difference between how we deal with someone who has an occasional bout of insomnia or how to optimize sleep in, you know, more of that normal healthy sleeper versus someone who's really dealing with insomnia. And I wouldn't recommend to figure it out on your own. I would say start with those resources that I mentioned.
Absolutely. And I will put links to the book you mentioned, to that podcast you mentioned, and a blog post that I actually did a few years ago, because it's funny that you mentioned that, Amy. I did go see a sleep therapist and she did cognitive CBT with me. And I did find that it worked. Like, it did help. I wouldn't say it completely cured it, but if nothing else, it removed the stress of, you know, I'm not going to die if I only get 6 hours instead of 8 hours and things like that. So I will definitely say to anyone listening, if this is something, it's not just a case of random, as you mentioned, and Amy said here, and I will attest to this, go see a cognitive therapist, because I'm glad you mentioned the association thing, because one thing my therapist said to me was, she said that I had associated my bed with like anger and frustration. So anytime I got into it, I was going into this kind of like, well, here we go again. I'm just going to lie here and like hating my bed, like dreading going to bed. And she made me remove myself from the situation. Anytime I couldn't fall asleep within 20 minutes, I had to leave that room. And you know, that was annoying because a lot of the time I was like, I don't want to get up, I'm tired, but I had to remove myself from that situation. And often I found I would actually fall asleep on the couch because there wasn't that pressure to fall asleep.
That is a key component to the cognitive behavioral therapy, is not associating your bed with anything other than sleep or sex. And so you really want to not do anything other than those two activities in bed. And you want to restrict the time in bed that you're awake. Mm-hmm. And so one of the techniques for cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is to actually shorten the sleep window. So many people with insomnia think that I need more time because I'm only getting 5 hours. So I need to extend the time in bed. But one of the techniques is to actually shorten the time in bed so that when you are in bed, you're sleeping and you're tired. And that was a great point and a great tip for everyone, that if you've been there lying awake for 15, 20 minutes, you need to get up out of bed and only return to bed when you're sleepy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that's what I did. And she also did the sleep restriction with me, which was not fun. It was effective. So I definitely, again, just want to highlight, go see someone. I know it's money. I know it's things you don't want to do. And people are embarrassed of going to therapists, but there's nothing wrong with it. But I genuinely feel like that helps so much. So I wanted to get that as something you mentioned. And you've kind of answered another question I was going to ask about this is, you know, when people have a race and, you know, maybe it's gone well, maybe it hasn't, they're physically exhausted, but they can't switch their mind off. It is racing, just kind of replaying the day. We're so tired, but we can't sleep. You've said about that being the sympathetic nervous system kind of essentially in fight or flight mode. But is it in that situation, is that the same kind of thing that you should just kind of get up and move and go somewhere else? Maybe, you know, don't use that as a time. I usually allow myself to kind of sit and play around on the internet on one of those nights after a race and I just mm-hmm. can't sleep. But what would be the best thing for someone to do if there is the night after a race and they just cannot switch their brain off? Like not even just for the first 20 minutes, half an hour, but I'm talking like 3-4 hours afterwards because you're still kind of feel like your mind is kind of racing or just like on fast forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the principle still applies. So if you're not sleepy, you shouldn't be in bed. Mm-hmm. So doing those relaxing activities and just kind of counting on those nights, you know, I might be going to bed at 2 a.m, maybe read a book. And, you know, I don't want to, a TV show is not the worst of what we're talking about here. So a lot of it has to do with light. Yes. And how bright it is and how close it is to your face or your eyes. So in the grand scheme of things, if we're talking about a cell phone versus a tablet versus a TV, the TV is going to be the least of the evils.
Okay.
And so because it's further away, it may not be as bright. It's not, you know, it's not as close to your eyes. And many people find that activity to be relaxing. So I wouldn't necessarily rule that out. I mean, if you can avoid it, but after those race days, if that's what relaxes you, you know, go for it and just kind of plan on not getting your usual amount of sleep and to try and a lot of it's related to the hormones that are being released, the adrenaline, maybe the light exposure that's occurring. And so I think after the race in the nights following, hopefully we can kind of make up for that. Mm-hmm. And if you could potentially supplement with a nap following that short sleep on the race night, that would be helpful.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned about the blue light and the, you know, the difference between a phone and a TV as well, because there is a big difference, like you said, even just the distance from your face. And you can get those blue light glasses, which I actually have a pair.
Me too.
Yes, from my insomnia days. I tried everything. Like, I'm not kidding. I tried everything. I even used to listen to those Sleep With Me podcasts where the guy just talks in a really monotone voice. And oh, I would get okay. so mad because I'd make it all the way through an episode and I'd be like, what the hell? This doesn't work. So the blue light glasses, is that just a gimmick or is that actually something that will allow you to use your phone? Or is it the principle of you're still kind of filling your mind with things to think about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't mention that it's not just about the light. It's mm-hmm. about the content that we're looking at. So there isn't actually a lot of research in this area, and I think it will be an emerging area, but we haven't quite parsed that out yet to understand whether the light is more of the culprit for poor sleep, or if it's actually the content that we're looking at, or the interaction with the device. So that's an important note, is that it's not just about the light. It's also about the content that we're looking at. I think, you know, having Flux technology installed on all your devices, and so that's a blue light filter that you can put using apps. So Twilight is an example, using night shift mode on your iOS device. Are really minimums that people should be having.
Okay.
You should have those absolutely installed. For me and for the athletes that we're working with, they're doing a lot of travel, so international travel. And so those blue light blocking glasses were important for them because we want to block out light during certain times of day to prepare for the trip ahead of time. And so those blue light blocking glasses were important. I think if you have a teenager who, you know, has to do work at night, homework, and wants to be on their device, having the blue light blocking glasses will help mitigate some of that blue light. But it's important to realize that it's also about the content and the excitement that we're getting from the device.
Absolutely. I actually was talking to a friend about this the other day, and this is a little bit off topic, but she was telling me that she had just randomly decided that she was going to go off social media. And she said that she one day decided, oh, I'm just going to go check on everything like a month or so later. And she said she could distinctly remember feeling this kind of feeling of like pressure afterwards, like, oh, that person had a baby, I need to go congratulate them. Oh, it's that person's birthday, I need to remember to send them a message. Oh, that person's having a rough time, I better make sure to reach out. And she said she remembered feeling kind of this like, oh, I've got to do that, like adding to her to-do list of like, got to do this, and why am I not doing that, and all these things. So I would more expect it to be the content and just what it's filling our brain with, what we need to do, than anything else. But very interesting, and I hope there are some studies coming on that in the future, because it will be very interesting to hear about. Now, what about if you're waking up in the night? You mentioned that a little bit more, but what about people who, you know, wake up, manage to fall asleep, but kind of wake up and can't stop thinking about something? Are there supplements that work to keep you asleep? Or is this a case of having a pen and paper by the bed and you just write it down, even if it doesn't, you know, make any sense? You can't see what you're writing, you get out of your head. What are some things you would say about if someone keeps waking up in the night?
Well, I think we need to try and understand better why that's happening. So many times with a sleep disorder, so for example, sleep apnea, you wake up during the middle of the night and don't even realize, you know, what the cause is. So if this is occurring multiple times per night, you're awake for more than 20 minutes, you know, I think we would want to look into that further, you know, to really figure out what's going on here and what's the problem. If it's stress-related and it's only occurring every so often, let's give this person techniques to help them get back to sleep. So I would start with the 4-7-8 breathing.
Yep.
You could then go on to the cognitive shuffle, which is a technique that I really like. And it's where you think of a word. So let's say bedtime, and you imagine all the objects that start with B that you can think of until you run out of those objects. So bed, baby, ball, you imagine those objects. When you can't think of any more, you move on to E, you move on to D, and that kind of gets your mind off thinking, oh, I need to go back to bed. And hopefully, you know, that technique will work for you. It works for me quite often.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that one.
Mm-hmm. And even like progressive muscle relaxation, so tensing parts of your body, relaxing them, kind of moving on up the line can be important. And then, you know, if you've gotten to that point and you're still not asleep, I would get up out of bed, do a relaxing activity in low light, and then return to bed when you're sleepy. But really trying to figure out why is this occurring, and if it is occurring frequently, to get it checked out by a sleep specialist.
Okay, great. And So supplements, you would say to kind of stay away from them as, until last resort?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I forgot to mention about the supplements.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't particularly recommend any supplement. I mean, I think the evidence is mixed. You know, if we're talking about magnesium or we're talking about melatonin, you know, the evidence is really mixed out there. So I wouldn't really recommend one per se. I think there are some interesting ones coming up. You know, for example, tart cherry juice was one that really intrigued me, and how it increases melatonin, which helps us fall asleep quicker and improves our sleep quality. That might be something to check out. But in general, you know, melatonin supplements in particular can be problematic just because the studies have shown that what you're actually getting from what it says on the bottle to what you're getting could be minus 55% to plus 300% of what is actually in there. So those can be problematic. So you want to get a trusted brand that I would recommend in the case of someone preparing for jet lag, that would be effective. And then also for maybe more of that evening type to help shift their rhythm earlier, we find a very low dose, 0.5 milligrams can be effective
for
shifting those rhythms. So it's nothing crazy, and you really have to worry about what you're actually getting.
Well, and it's very easy to get addicted to them because, like, they do work. And when you stop taking them, you suddenly don't just fall asleep at the click of a fingers. And that can be hard to get, you know, it's easy to become a crutch where you just reach for it. And I would find that taking like an eighth of a tablet was enough, because if I took a whole one, I went completely like loopy. Like, it was like quite scary actually how like just out of it I was if I took one of those. So especially if I tried to take it on a plane, I would feel like hysterical because I couldn't, you know, I was like, I just don't want to be here anymore. So, I learned my lesson with those. So be very careful, listeners, if you do go kind of that route. Okay. Just the last one before we get on to just a few more questions that I have related to this. What about morning wake ups? You mentioned people who wake up early. That's still kind of a sign that something's going on. Again, when I had my rough patch, it was it felt like someone just switched on to me, and it was like ping. I was like wide awake at 4 a.m. So I know this is something a lot of other people listening struggle with as well. What happens if you manage to go to sleep okay, or maybe take a while, but still wake up very early and just kind of feel very restless in bed? Is that a sign of something else going on?
It could be. Yes, it could be. I mean, if you talk about sleep apnea, during REM sleep, our muscles become kind of paralyzed. And I don't want to freak anyone out or anything, but in the morning times is when we have more of that REM sleep. And so there might be a higher likelihood of your airway closing because you're in REM, which is more frequently occurring in the morning. So there still could be something going on there. It could also be that you're more of that morning type. So shifting, if you could block light at night and shift your bedtime earlier, it may be that 5 a.m. would be kind of your optimal wake-up time.
Okay.
That could be the case as well. So there's definitely things you could explore related to that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then finally, you mentioned, you know, people waking up in the night, and we've talked about someone staying up. How much does it affect your kind of the restorative properties, the benefits of sleep, if you are waking up often, and especially like if you have to, you know, get up to go to the bathroom? Is that like, how much impact is that having? I know we have a lot of older listeners, and Lucy in particular wanted to ask about, you know, someone going through menopause, might be waking up, might be needing to pee, things like that. How does that actually affect the quality of your sleep?
Mm-hmm. This has been kind of an elusive question, I think, in the sleep field. But recently, they've actually put a definition on what good quality sleep is. It's from the National Sleep Foundation. And they found that, you know, you want to be sleeping at least 85% of the the time that you're in bed. So if I'm in bed for 10 hours, you know, I want to be sleeping for 8.5 hours.
You mean like not conscious or kind of even in that kind of drowsy state?
Even in the drowsy state. Okay. And there's, you mentioned, I know you struggled with insomnia, and there's actually evidence that those who have insomnia think they have a misperception of how much sleep they're actually getting.
Yes.
So they may think that, oh, I didn't go to sleep. But in reality, when you look at the EEG, they actually did, but it could have been in a much lighter stage of sleep. So if, let's say, you're in bed for 10 hours, which is would be in bed for a long time, according to this rule, you know, you would want to be sleeping 8.5 hours during that time. So 85% of the time that you're in bed, you want to be sleeping. They mentioned that you want to be able to fall asleep in 30 minutes or less. So that is a good sign that you're having good quality of sleep, that you want to wake up no more than once per night. So going to the bathroom, waking up, you know, once per night, having to go to the bathroom is completely normal. I wouldn't be fretting over that. And then the other thing they mentioned is you don't want to be awake for more than 20, 30 minutes at a time.
Okay.
So if you're waking up during the middle of the night, you're going to the bathroom and then you go right back to bed, not a big deal at all. That would still be considered having good quality sleep. But if you're waking up, having to go to the bathroom, takes you 45 minutes to fall back to sleep, then, you know, there may be some sleep quality issues going on.
Okay. And with the going to the bathroom, you mentioned once is kind of normal and that's okay. Is there kind of a guideline if you are waking up more than that to go pee to maybe, you know, not drink as much in the evenings, or are there any other suggestions on that? Like, can you essentially go back to sleep even if you may need to go? I mean, I know I've had that sensation of like, I'm going to try and sleep. No, I can't. I really have to go, and I get up anyway. But sometimes I almost feel like it's a bit of a reset mentally to like, okay, let's try again.
Mm-hmm.
But if someone's waking up more than once a night to go to the bathroom, then what would you say?
I think if it's combined with snoring, poor quality sleep, like feeling really tired during the day, that could be a sign of sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. Because there's actually evidence to show that I think it's maybe more than one time per night waking up to go to the bathroom is a sign of sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. So I would get that checked out.
Okay.
You know, for athletes, it's common. They need to hydrate. That's an important part of training and recovery. And so trying to limit that water intake earlier on in the day, if you can, is really important. Trying to avoid even herbal teas.
Okay.
Before bed, because that can cause you to wake up more and have to go to the bathroom. So yeah, really trying to shift that hydration earlier on in the day, and then maybe do more of like sipping water before bed, you know, not guzzling down a gallon of water is going to be a good strategy for people, trying to shift it earlier and then avoiding herbal teas.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then one final question I want to ask you. The night before a race, a competition, how much does it affect someone? I think I know the answer to this. How much does it affect someone if they can't sleep because they're nervous, they're excited, they can't seem to switch off? Is that going to affect performance?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
<I'm laughs> what did you think?
No, I'd heard that wasn't the case, that, you know, the night before the race, it's kind of expected, anticipated. And then in that case, it's two nights before that is essentially more important. Is that true? Or is it just kind of the overall build up, maybe the week of?
Yes. So one of our amazing strategies that you need to do is to bank sleep a week leading into the competition. So the studies have shown that banking sleep, so getting more sleep prior to that competition, prior to that sleep deprivation period, is going to help you perform better with not a night of sleep that was crappy the night before the competition. So we use this. Actually, I worked with Dave Proctor, who, I don't know if you've heard of him, but he attempted to run across Canada in 66 days, running 100 kilometers a day. Mm-hmm. starting on the West Coast, you know, heading east. Unfortunately, he had an injury, so he didn't quite make it across. But one of my strategies that I used for him was to bank sleep 2-3 weeks out prior to the start of that. And it really, really helped him in the beginning when he wasn't getting good sleep. And for him, he was only getting 4 to 5 hours of sleep per night. For him, it was more related to anxiety. So he had to make certain kilometers in order to make it to the next event the next day, you know, where he had an event meeting people in certain areas. And so for him, it was anxiety related, and banking that sleep leading into that really helped him get through that initial part of the sleep deprivation he was suffering from.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for letting us know about that, because obviously if it can help someone with a challenge like that, then it's something that can definitely help us as just doing more normal feats, shall we say, of just as difficult for us in some ways. Okay, Amy, before we get on to the Running for Real 4, any final tactics or tips you would give for people with sleep?
One thing we didn't talk about was caffeine. Mm. So I am huge into decaf. I no longer drink caffeinated coffee because of the impact on sleep quality. And I'm probably like the most, downer episode, because I'm telling people you can't look at your devices. You know, you need to do a pre-sleep routine. You need to eliminate caffeine. But for me, I found, you know, during graduate school, I was downing the coffee and I was up to 2-3 cups a day, not even realizing the impact on my sleep quality, just trying to get through grad school, you know, and had to restart the day with coffee or else I would feel absolutely exhausted. Yeah. And I didn't attempt to go decaf until my youngest was about 6-7 months old. So, you know, I lived on the caffeine when my kids were little. But currently I drink decaf coffee. I wake up feeling refreshed. If I'm really struggling, I might have a green tea in the afternoon, but I really limit my caffeine intake. And I think that depends on your sensitivity to caffeine. Mm-hmm. So there are fast metabolizers of caffeine where this probably isn't as big of an issue, about 50% of the population. And then 50% of us are more of those slow metabolers like myself, where caffeine does impact your sleep quality. There was actually a study that showed a 7 a.m. administration of 200 milligrams of caffeine impacted their deep sleep or that quality sleep. Wow. At night. You know, so I think you have to be careful. For me, I didn't even realize I was a slow metabolizer when I was in grad school and I was continually dependent on it. But I think for people, if you want to take your sleep quality to the next level, limiting your caffeine intake is a way to do that.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining that. And I think that is an important thing to bring up, and definitely something that affects a lot of people, I'm sure, whether they realize it or not. Okay, we're just going to take a moment to thank our sponsors and we'll be back with the Running for Real 4. I was excited to introduce you to Aftershocks in that mind-blowing episode with Ray McClanahan a few weeks ago, and I'm really thankful to Aftershocks for sponsoring this episode. I've heard from many of you just how much you loved your Aftershocks, and now I can definitely see what all the fuss is about. In fact, I've been wearing them for all my long runs in training for the Boston Marathon. They're so comfortable that I don't feel the need to rip them off and rub my ears as they hurt as soon as I click stop on my watch. You barely notice they're there, really. I also love that you hear your music or you're running for a podcast, or I suppose any other podcast you listen to, through the bone conduction technology. I wasn't sure I'd be a fan of that, to be honest. Vibrating through my cheekbones, that sounded like a recipe for me feeling dizzy, but I was wrong. Not only did I feel no dizziness whatsoever, but I absolutely love the fact that I can hear my music or podcast while also hearing sounds of the environment around me. I feel safer and feel like crossing the road is wasn't risking my life every time. And I can hear the sounds of nature. You know, the good parts of actually being out on a run that we can easily miss when we have in-ear headphones. As a Running For Real listener, you can get $50 off a Trex Titanium Endurance Bundle at tina.aftershocks.com. That's tina.aftershocks, whichever you prefer, .com, and go see what all the buzz is about. Get yourself a pair. Do you ever feel like every runner should have an equal share of injuries, and once you hit that quota, you're done with them for life? No more injuries ever again? Wouldn't that be so nice? Except we all know that life doesn't work that way, and running certainly doesn't work that way. Now, I've had plenty of injuries in my years of running, but I've been fortunate enough to be able to say that my knees have not been one of my trouble areas, although saying that I'm probably going to jinx myself. However, I know that knee pain is one of the most, it may even be the most, common running issues. And when runner's knee hits, it can be miserable for a long time as well. Two-time Ironman Mike Emmeling was fed up with dealing with it after 5 years of a constant battle. He decided to use his engineering brain to create his own solution, and he kept going until he found one that worked. Nuni is an innovative new product designed to provide immediate relief of runner's knee symptoms. Elite athletes use it, recreational runners use it, and even running injury specialist Dr. Ben Chateau prescribes it to his runners. Some superstars are testing it out as we speak, and I'll be excited to share their feedback in a few weeks. Knee pain can be debilitating, so let Nuni get you back to your running schedule and stop runner's knee in its tracks. You can go to nunishop.com and use promo code TINAMUA for 20% off. That's NUNEESHOP.com and use code TINAMUIR for 20% off. All right, Amy, four more questions for you, starting with a piece of advice you'd like to give the listeners for life.
I would say prioritize sleep as much as you can. I mean, we talked about how important it is. Mm-hmm. Don't just let it fall off the wayside when you get busy. I mean, it's so important for our health, our yes. well-being, to really try and prioritize. And, you know, life happens. We get busy, we have events, but just trying to make up for that sleep. Can you take a maybe your little recovery nap? Can you sleep in a little bit longer on the weekends to try and make up for that lost sleep?
Great. Thank you so much. All right. One person to follow on social media.
Let's see. I would say if you're looking for more advice on sleep and different kind of interesting things that come out, I really like following Dr. Michael Grandner. So he's at Michael Grandner, and he really frequently post stuff on really cool studies that come out related to sleep.
Cool. That's great. I will put a link in the show notes. Third, how do you want to be remembered on this podcast?
Let's see. I mean, I am really on a mission to promote sleep for well-being and better performance. So that's kind of my tagline in my social media. I just really want to promote the benefits of sleep and how that will improve your well-being.
Absolutely. You are absolutely doing that. And the fact that Christy Ashwanden, who told us just a few weeks ago how important sleep is as the number one recovery tool, and she was the one who recommended you, I think that's a pretty heavy nod that you are doing the right thing. And finally, what do you tell yourself before you give a presentation or on the start line, getting ready to do some kind of performance activity?
I would say, let's do this. Yeah. Like, let's get after it. Let's do it.
Yeah. Love that. Okay, great. All right, Amy, how can people find out more about you and follow along in the future?
So I'm on Twitter. I'm fairly active on Twitter, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm on Instagram at Sleep for Sport.
Okay, great. Well, Amy, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful chat. I've really appreciated your advice. I know my listeners have too. And thank you so much for helping us to enjoy our lives more, because if we sleep better, we will be happier and just not as moody people, which is going to make everyone just a little bit better. So thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you so much, Tina. Sleep well, everyone.
My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast. Or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. Was that helpful? I thought so. Some really interesting findings Amy had there, and I'm glad that she explained about the pressure thing that we put on sleep. I find it so frustrating when I just want to sleep, but I can't, especially after a race when you're just exhausted. Now, as I mentioned in the episode, I did go to a sleep therapist, and if you try the tips Amy talked about and they don't work either, which looking back, they probably wouldn't have worked for me because I felt like I tried everything. Seriously, go see someone. It will help a lot. There's nothing wrong with going to see a therapist about this kind of thing. And, you know, what, like we've talked about, if you get your sleep sorted, it could change your whole life. And remember to let me know if you are planning on coming to the meetup in Boston on April 14th. I hope to see you at Tracksmith at 12 p.m. on the 14th. Send me an email, tina@tinamuir.com, to learn more and just let me know that you're coming. You can also send me an email if you want to get the show notes emailed to you or visit the show notes link at tinamuir.com/episode106. And then that'll be the last time you visit the show notes, as then after that, they will come right to you. Next week, you will get to hear from my sports psychologist, Evie Civenti. We are answering your questions. This is going to be fascinating for you. And I love how you give me questions that are things that many of us have wondered about, but I just didn't come to mind when I was thinking of questions. So thank you to the superstars for helping with that. I hope you have a great week. I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.